We'll proceed to the last case for this morning, United States against Poole.
May it please the court. Good morning. My name is Gregory Mitchell, and I represent Mr. Melvane Poole. Your Honors, in the brief from Mr. Poole, we essentially raise, it's two issues, but it's essentially one. The idea with respect to whether the district court committed clear error by deciding this aggregation of the drug quantity, that they had sufficient evidence that was reliable. Clearly, the judge was careful in deciding what to consider, but when it came down to the sentencing hearing, she identified that it was simply one factor, and that was the testimony of Juan Correll, which was the main drug supplier. And the reason why the defendant had maintained for 3 years in pretrial custody that that was the only evidence against him, that was clearly not sufficient, even for the conspiracy charge, let alone for relevant conduct to increase his sentence from level 20 to 28 levels, or 8 levels to 28, is that Mr. Correll had given totally inconsistent statements from the beginning all the way through the end. And in fact, if you go through the detailed evidence, and as you can see from my brief, I was attorney number 5 that was appointed to represent the defendant, and it appears when I got the case that the defendant knew his case better than most. And so after talking with him and discussing this matter, I did go through every single DEA-6 and every government report to identify every prior statement that the main cocaine supplier had provided to government from the time that he was initially arrested, from every interview that he cooperated with, all of the number of defendants that were named in this case, to identify what he exactly said about this defendant. And I pointed out in the government's, in my brief to the sentencing judge before that, in the suppression hearing, that he essentially had not even properly identified this defendant because he had a brother who was involved here as well, who lived in the same residence. And so there was no distinction initially made in the numbers or the quantities of drugs that were given or sold to my defendant throughout. And it wasn't until 3 years later, Judge, and he's in jail now for 36 months, that now the distinction of who, what Poole is he talking about, showing the signature or his picture, that there's any indication that now he recalls how much drugs or how many transactions. The problem is, Judge, is that this court has said that given the very heavy burden that the defendant would have to defend, given the leeway that the government has with relevant conduct, this court needs to look for something more. The district judge needs to look for something more. And in Beller, the court kind of gave you a linear list of things to look at.
But didn't the district judge, I mean, there's all sorts of evidence in this case about drug quantities. And I understood the district judge to be taking the most conservative approach that she possibly could, namely these 20 deliveries of an eighth of a kilogram apiece for 2.5 kilograms. And she disregards all sorts of other evidence, not because it's not there, but she's looking for some standard of reliability. But she concludes, essentially, you just can't go below this 2.5-kilogram level. That's a methodology district judges use all the time.
There is, and usually when you deal with quantities like that, there's other indicia of reliability, such as records or money or some sort of ongoing transactions or relationship with the parties. In this case, Judge, and that's where the error here, what I see, even though the clear error standard is a very high standard to get beyond, if this had been a simple buy-bust relationship or somehow our conspiracy was only 2 or 3 months, then you would can say that that evidence alone would probably be sufficient. But that's not what happened in this case. You have an undercover investigation with confidential informants, Title III, search warrants, and the like. And all you get at the end of the day is the individual who can't recall any particular transaction, how many occurred in a given 3 or 4 month period. There's a period of time where he talks about the telephone calls, and the government relies heavily on the number of connections first from the PIN register, and then they mention that there were 11 actual calls. And what I pointed out to the district judge, but it took 6 calls to talk about one drug deal, and that one drug deal was 4.5 ounces. So if it takes 6 calls to get one drug deal, how do you aggregate that there must have been 20, especially when the individual can't even define when it occurred on any given month? And I asked him specifically on cross-examination, month by month, can you give me any day or any month that you've had a transaction? Other than the Title III transaction, he could not give you any. All he could do is help the government. And the motivation for him to lie in this case was just incredible, Your Honors, because he was looking at life, and he was the key government witness who had testified in two other cases. And so what you have here is that on direct examination, he's being led, well, how many times conservatively would you estimate that you had a transaction with this individual? And he can't recall, and he goes over it. And then by being led to the government, the 30 number is thrown out, and he says possibly 30. And then if it's 20, definitely 20. And that's the magic number with the 2.5. The question is, Judge, he could not even describe three transactions, hand-to-hand transaction where he said he sold drugs, not even three. So if he just simply talks about if you simply look at the phone calls, if you look at the relationship, and even the amount of money. The other phone call, Judge, and this is the key, they had a search warrant that was done in Mr. Poole's residence. And the government doesn't dispute that there were three or four Pools living at that residence. The search warrant does not reveal that there's an ongoing relationship between the two people. But not only that, the phone call is done in July or June of 2002. There's surveillance conducted because now Mr. Correll is a cooperating witness. Mr. Poole's residence is searched in November, nearly 6 months. And now you have surveillance, and there isn't one transaction. There's not one between that entire six-month period of time where you can indicate that they have this ongoing, continual relationship. So our position is that it simply was not credible to now allow Mr. Correll 3 years later to say, I can't remember one transaction other than the phone call, but I know it's at least 20 or 30. The only other issue that I raise, Judge, is with respect to the Sixth Amendment. And I know that this court has already decided recently in Robinson and Wright that was cited by the government that the Seventh Circuit has said, yes, the judge can do fact-finding on relevant conduct. And I raise it simply because there's a division within the circuits, and I'm not quite sure how the Supreme Court is going to come out with respect to the sentence.
To preserve it for the Supreme Court. We have, in fact, spoken on a number of occasions to it, but you're certainly entitled to preserve the argument for your client.
And so essentially I would simply say, Judge, that given the two together, whether or not in this particular case due process under these facts have been violated and the fact-finding that was taken by this court clearly had the authority to do so, maybe in this case it should not have been exercised. Thank you.
Ms. Brown?
May it please the court. With respect to the first issue, the district court did not clearly err by finding the defendant responsible for 2.5 kilograms of cocaine. That finding was based on the government's most conservative estimate for the amount of cocaine for which the defendant was responsible. That estimate was in turn based on the testimony of Juan Correll, which the district court found just about as credible as testimony can get in a case such as this. And in contrast, the district court characterized the defendant's own testimony as being stranger than any fiction that the district court had ever seen. Based on that finding, there is certainly no clear error on the district court's part with respect to the drug quantity. With respect to the second issue that defendant raises, the district court did not violate the defendant's Sixth Amendment right to a jury trial by engaging in judicial fact-finding. As this court has found, as defendant notes, and as Your Honor points out, Judge Wood, that this court has rejected repeatedly the contention that judicial fact-finding on guidelines adjustments and uncharged relevant conduct within an advisory guideline scheme violates the Sixth Amendment. Unless there are any further questions from the panel, the government would respectfully request that this court affirm the defendant's sentence.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mitchell, you still have some time. 3 minutes.
I would just like to point out to the court what was really at stake during this entire process. What we have is Mr. Poole, given the transactions and the evidence that he had, was facing a level 19 to 20, which would have been 30 to 38 months. But the government had maintained, because of the conspiracy involvement that they had, that he should have been subject to this higher quantity, and I believe at the time it was between 78 and 87 months. Essentially, what the court finally came down to was that it was between 57 and 71 months, and in fact gave him the low end of the guidelines after the government dismissed the conspiracy charge. The real question here is whether or not, given the facts of this case, when you go into judicial fact-finding to determine relevant conduct and thereby determine what the applicable guidelines are in the first instance, which in this case changed it dramatically. It's one thing to have a guideline range that overlaps, but when you have a guideline range, once you start using judicial fact-finding to essentially establish what that new range is going to be, we would argue it would go into the realm of due process violation, which this court really hasn't directly addressed specifically. We would ask that you would overturn it and have him to be resentenced. Thank you.
Thank you. And you were appointed, were you not, Mr. Mitchell?
Yes.
We thank you very much for your service to the court and to your client. Thank you as well. The court will be adjourned until further notice.
Brian, please tell Judge Flom that we appreciate, even though he only has 12 more days to be the chief, that he's agreed to switch places with the new chief.
That's right.
Judge Easterman.
That's right.
Very nice of him.